From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Thank you very much. It's great to have Prime Minister Abe, a friend of mine and somebody we've just developed a great relationship. And it's wonderful to have you here.
U.S. President Donald Trump Friday sat down with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at the G7 summit in Sicily.
We'll be discussing many things, including, of course, North Korea, which is very much on our minds. We'll be discussing terrorism, but I think we will really be in particular focused on the North Korea problem. It's a big problem. It's a world problem. And it will be solved. At some point, it will be solved.
Shortly before the Trump-Abe meeting, the foreign ministers of two of Korea's neighbors, Russia and China, met in Moscow and held a press conference. This was Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi early Friday.
Ladies and gentlemen, our talks have taken place in the sphere of friendship, mutual trust and respect. That is a traditional atmosphere for our dialogue with our Chinese friends. Using this opportunity, I congratulated the Minister of Foreign Relations and the authorities of China with a successful completion in May this year, an international forum, One Belt, One Road, which took place in Beijing. No doubt, our cooperation on that track will further facilitate gradual development and dovetailing of many processes on the vast territories of Eurasia, including within the framework of the arrangements reached by the leaders of the two countries on the major Eurasian project and the One Road, One Belt project development. On both sides, we confirm today the high evaluation of the relations, of the high level of relations between the countries, as well as the cooperation which is now on the unprecedented level. We have discussed the schedule for political contacts, which is very intensive, I should say, and paid separate attention to the upcoming visit of the head of China, Xi Jinping. As for the topical points of the international agenda, they will be discussed by the leaders of our countries on the many platforms and forums which will take place in the world. Also, the head of government, Prime Minister of Russia, Mr. Medvedev, will visit China to participate in the 22nd regular meeting of the heads of government. We believe that the cooperation between Russia and China is a major stabilizing factor in the international affairs. We agreed to build up our coordination and our cooperation as per our cooperation within the BRICS group and the United Nations in the eve of the meeting and as well as our meeting within the framework of the CSO and other platforms and multilateral forums. We have discussed and exchanged our opinions on many regional topics. Our views are similar in what concerns the Syrian Arab Republic, and we mean the support for the Astana process, where we reached an agreement to create in Syria the de-escalation zones, as we call them, and to implement this project, this initiative. This will be a very important aspect of supporting the ceasefire, alleviating the plight of people and creating a favorable environment for the start of an inclusive inner Syrian dialogue in Geneva, as formulated in the documents agreed upon by the Security Council of the United Nations. We paid special attention to the situation on the Korean Peninsula. We have confirmed that we will continue to abide, to call upon all the stakeholders to abide by the relevant resolutions of the Security Council. We stand for the measures which, on the one hand, would be prevent the prevent North Korea from developing their missile programs, and on the other hand, will prevent any confrontation and tensions build up, allowing for a peaceful and diplomatic resolution of the nuclear issue on the peninsula. We, China and Russia, stand for complete denuclearization of the peninsula. We deem counterproductive any attempts to use the Pyongyang's actions as a motive for build-up of military capabilities, unnecessary military capabilities in the region, as, and we mean the anti-missile deployment in the region by the United States. We again confirmed our willingness to broaden and to deepen our multifaceted cooperation, strategic cooperation and partnership, and inclusive work. Thank you.
大家好，很高兴同媒体的各位朋友见面。
我这次来莫斯科是一次例行的访问。一个主要的任务就是为习近平主席预定对俄罗斯进行的军事访问。刚才我和老朋友拉夫夫人进行了非常有成效的谈话。进行了非常有成效的谈话。当前国际格局正在经历深刻的变革。
Had talks with Mr. Lavrov and reached important agreements. International structure is changing, and our assessments and our stances on different issues align in many ways. Our bilateral ties are the best they've been throughout our history. Whatever happens in the international arena, our bilateral ties have to strengthen. We need to move forward and never back. But the negative rhetoric about Russia, China relations is ungrounded. Any attempt to drive a wedge between us.
习主席和普京总统
in the face of our solidarity.
会晤所达成的重要共识
According to the agreements reached by Xi Jinping and Mr. Putin during the Belt and Road Forum, are being realized very fast when it comes to energy, medicine, transport, and other spheres. We are seeing huge progress. We are convinced that our future has a lot of prospects. We believe our discussions will help the stability and peace in the world. We are ready to intensify our efforts to ensure business stability in the world. Soon, the CEO's expansion, the first round of it, will be over. We hope to strengthen solidarity and trust, facilitate international cooperation to ensure peace and stability in the region. Which will also help develop the economies of the member states. One of the important subjects, topics that we discussed was the situation on the Korean Peninsula. Our stances align.
We
believe in ensuring peace and stability, and we are against any rhetoric that intensifies tensions. We are willing to put every effort into denuclearizing the peninsula.
For more on that, we spoke with our regular political commentator, Professor Tony Montero. So an interesting study in contrast with Trump and Abe, two of the leaders of the old order on the one hand, and
Lavrov and Wang, or two of the leaders of the New Order, on the other, discussing some of the same matters.
Yeah, very interesting. And I'm glad you put it that way. The old and new order, you know, it was Antonio Gramsci that commented, the old is dying and the new is not yet ready to be born. I think we could say the old is dying and the new is being born. That's what we saw with Lavrov and Wang, as opposed to Abe and Trump, or Trump and the leaders of the G7, or Trump and the NATO officials in Brussels. The old is in an irreversible crisis. The American century, and I put quotes around that, as proclaimed by the U.S. hegemonists, among them John Foster Dulles and others, after World War II, is literally coming to a crashing end. And by that I mean not only NATO, but also the Bretton Woods agreements that made the dollar the equivalent of gold after World War II, set up the IMF and the World Bank, which are effectively international financial instruments or institutions controlled by U.S. finance capital and the U.S. dollar. All of that is coming to an end. It's an irreversible crisis. The new world, as represented not only by the press conference between Wang and Lavrov, but the upcoming meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping, but more than that, the Beijing summit on the One Belt, One Road policy, where I think, if I'm correct, upwards of 29 heads of state and maybe 100 nations were present in one or another way. This is the future. Wang and Lavrov spoke about a new Eurasian framework of political, economic, financial, trading, and other relationships. I think that going forward, we're looking at an African-Eurasian alliance, which even with India holding out for the time being, and I don't think they will hold out forever, we're looking at close to 60%, if not 70%, of humanity locked in a common trading, financial, political set of relationships, a new human solidarity. So the West is looking inward, beset by political and social and economic contradictions that are unresolvable on the foundations of neoliberal capitalism, and the East and South are looking to the future. This is the great historical turning point that we have been holding our breaths, waiting for many decades.
Now, we've seen like various pushes forward of this development with the creation of the BRICS, for example, and then some of the contradictions that have developed there, some still playing out, for example, in Brazil and South Africa. And also, in particular, I think the coming together in many ways of the geostrategic views of Russia and China. We saw with Syria, for example, they began to both veto attempts by the United States and France and the UK to intervene directly in Syria in one fashion or another. They did that together several times, both speaking against the various methodologies that were being proposed to, by the U.S. maybe singing slightly different lyrics, but the same song, essentially. And then just today with the foreign minister of China saying that the relationship between the two has never been closer and we will never look back.
No, that's huge. That's huge. And you know, they talked about two very combustible issues on the world scene right now, Syria and North Korea. And I think they understand this fact, that war with Syria is the start of war with Iran. And war with North Korea is the beginning of a war with China and Russia.
Right.
You know, and I think you can, if you look at the geostrategic map, it's understood. But here is the problem. War with Iran is a war that would cut off the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. Now, that's a big problem for nations like Saudi Arabia that just signed a $100 billion arms deal with the United States.
Right.
Well, if oil is cut off, how do they pay for that?
Right, they have to borrow it from China.
Say that one more time.
They'd have to borrow it from China.
Yeah, well, they'd have to borrow it from China. But the fact of the matter is that with the decline in the price of crude, especially that coming from the Persian Gulf, but worldwide, you know, this is causing deep social contradictions within Saudi Arabia. In fact, the situation in Bahrain, which is heating up politically once again, is but a first step towards a conflagration, a social conflagration within Saudi Arabia itself. The war with Yemen, the genocidal war, I should say, is becoming very unpopular among the people of Saudi Arabia. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a peace movement break out in Saudi Arabia, where the Saudi people are saying, in effect, war is the enemy of the poor in Saudi Arabia. So I say that to put it in the context of war with Iran. War with Iran would shut off the flow of oil and could plunge at least the West into a recession, a deep recession, if not a depression. Similarly, and we've talked about this before, a war on the peninsula of Korea would lead to economic depression within Northeast Asia, which would affect the world economy. What Wang and Lavrov were saying in their press conference, and what Putin and Xi Jinping will say when they meet in their summit, and what was said last week in the Beijing summit over the One Belt, One Road initiative, they are saying that the only path for humanity is through peaceful development, through trade, through an end to policies of hegemonism, an end to neoliberal globalization. Now, I am particularly interested in the continent of Africa. I think the outcomes and the expansion of the One Belt, One Road policies would in fact lead to what we saw take place in China over a couple of decades, and that is rates of growth of from 10 to 12% over a couple of decades. We're on the cusp of something great, a renaissance for humanity, an end to the age of Europe and the beginning of an age of Europe, a new configuration. All that the West, and especially the United States, has to offer humanity is war. Humanity has rejected that, and in so doing, have accepted and embraced the alternative to U.S. Hegemonism and war.
And you know, it's interesting that as this is happening, some of the first colonies of the U.S. Outside of the immediate region, in particular, Puerto Rico here, and in Asia, the Philippines are moving away. Particularly the Philippines with Duterte, who has now basically said, "Look, our future is with China and Russia, and not with the U.S." And you know, suddenly, by the way, he's starting to have problems with ISIS and such in his country, which he seems to be moving rather aggressively towards. And Russia has said, hey, you need help?
Yeah. And you know, Duterte also said that we don't need to get our arms from the United States. We can get them from Russia. And that's important because that is an end to an over 100-year military occupation and control of the Philippines by the United States. So that's very huge. And of course, Puerto Rico, the statehood forces are in decline, and the forces of independence for Puerto Rico are rising. I think the only way that Puerto Rico resolves this crisis is through independence and becoming a part of a new global economy that we see coming into being. You know, I would just along with that, since we're talking about neocolonialism and colonialism, you know, we have something that looks like that in many ways, and that is the oppression of the African American people in the United States. The situation since 2008, or you know, the beginning of the Great Recession, has gotten worse for the African American people. You know, I am more aware of what goes on in Philadelphia, and I study Philadelphia. I study the conditions of Black people, of the Philadelphia economy, of housing, and so on and so forth. And I can tell you, Don, that the levels of poverty, the levels of wretchedness, the levels of distress of the majority of the African American people are at levels that we have never seen in this city. We are the poorest of the top 10 cities. But here's the other part of it. We are the most incarcerated of all of the cities, major cities, in the United States.
Wow.
So we have poverty and incarceration, while at the same time, a downtown that glitters with new buildings. The people are more angry at their politicians and at the major institutions of the city, including the universities, than I've ever seen them. So we get a common pattern. Puerto Rico, and let us say Black Philadelphia, look and feel very similar. The only difference is Black Philadelphians have nowhere to go. They can't leave Philadelphia. They don't have anywhere to go. So we are compelled to fight our battles right here. I would say that in the not that distant future, we could see leadership like Duterte emerge in communities across the country, like Black Philadelphia. This will be huge. And you know, not wanting to talk too much. You see, how and when will the American people become a part of this grand historic moment that we're talking about? This is happening in Asia. This is happening with this One Belt, One Road policy, a new historical moment. When will the and how will the American people become a part of that? I think the path to that is quintessentially through the African-American struggle, which can produce and probably will produce a type of leadership of the Malcolm X type, who talked back in the 1960s about the Afro-Asian solidarity and how the African-American people were a part of or had to become a part of this new Afro-Asiatic movement. I think we might see something very similar develop in this country, in the black communities around the nation.
People were referring, particularly Malcolm, referring to black America as an internal colony.
Yes, yes. And it looks like that. I mean, and commentators and researchers had been talking about this for decades, that Harlem back in the 70s and early 80s, the situation was more like Bangladesh than the rest of America, than the rest, than being similar to the conditions of America generally. I can tell you that North Philadelphia, in particular, that I know very, very well, North Philadelphia is as bad as parts of the Philippines, and certainly resembles Puerto Rico in terms of the crisis that we face.
Maybe there's a model available looking at it. It started to happen in Latin America and the Caribbean 20 years ago, really, with the election of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and the developments that followed. An independent path, diversity of political and economic systems, the various integration models that were developed, CELAC, the Mercosur, ALBA, all these different things. And then, as that developed, of course, the counterattack took place, and we see that still being waged now on the streets of Venezuela and Brazil, to name two places, Argentina, elsewhere. And so I'm wondering if there's some modeling there that would be useful to people both in the internal colonies here in the U.S. and Black America, Puerto Rico, or whatever, and the external colonies that are breaking free, for example, the Philippines and Turkey also.
Well, yeah, I think so, especially in this age where information flows more freely than in the past. You know, one of the big things in the black community is the crisis of the black misleadership class. We just had a DA's race here in Philadelphia. And what was so extraordinary about it is that it continued a pattern begun in the 2015 mayoral race, where black Philadelphia overwhelmingly voted in the mayoral race for a white race moderate over the black misleadership class candidate. In this race, which was even more striking, the black community voted for a white progressive, for DA, which in many ways, in life and death terms, is more important than the mayor.
Yeah.
Black Philadelphia voted for the white progressive Larry Krasner over the candidate of a big part of the black misleadership class. And voted for him at levels of 60%. Wow. You know what I'm saying? So there is a crisis of political leadership in the black community and a rejection of the old black misleadership class paradigm. That happened here in Philadelphia in the presidential race. And it was because of black Philadelphians staying at home and frankly, a yet uncounted and undetected number of them voting for Trump. But the stay-home vote and the Trump vote and the Jill Stein vote led to Trump was in part a big part of Trump taking the state of Pennsylvania. Right. But it was a rejection of the black misleadership class and their appeals to stay the course, in particular Barack Obama.
And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.